I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series on conflicts in the Middle East, focusing on Syria, part three. During the first two parts, we've been exploring different aspects, and we also took a look at, with Professor Norman Pollack, the historical context. Today, a series of commentaries by Alistair Crook from Consortium News, Lost on the Dark Side in Syria. From Robert Perry from Consortium News, Can Obama Level with the People? Also today, Peter Van Buren, What If They Gave a War and Everybody Came? From Tom Dispatch. Also, we'll be adding in Lawrence Davidson, Is Assad Part of the Solution? As well as we'll have audio clips from multiple sources giving us their insights. These are all pieces of a puzzle. And as each one, I will try to see where it fits and share that insight with you. Let's begin. First from Alison Crook. He says, when in early August, the Pentagon's former highest-ranking intelligence officer, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, said that it had been a willful decision by the West, meaning the United States, to back the establishment of a declared and undeclared Salafist presence in eastern Syria in order to bring pressure on the Syrian government, and then went on to confirm that the recently declassified 2012 U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency report on the rise of ISIS in Syria had explicitly warned of the possibility of a, quote, an Islamic state being declared, quote, through a union of other terrorist organizations in Iraq and Syria, end quote. There was virtually silence in the mainstream media. No one wanted to touch the live wire of possible U.S. collusion with caliphate forces. But it was clear enough what the American general was saying. The jihadification of the Syrian conflict had been a willful policy, and that since Al-Qaeda and ISIS as an embryo were the only movements capable of establishing such a caliphate across Syria and Iraq, then it plainly followed that the United States administration and its allies tactically accepted this outcome in the interest of weakening or overthrowing the Syrian state. Many in the West found General Flynn's comments hard to believe. In spite of his direct knowledge of the events, he was at the top of the food chain. He was one of the people counseling the President of the United States directly. How could this be? It must have seemed so counterintuitive to most of the people in the United States who knew about this, and it's something which touches on a wound in the Western psyche, meaning 9/11. But now, with Russia and Iran's military intervention, the Syrian mess in which the West finds itself is only too evident. Russia is providing air cover to the Syrian army, intent on severing the insurgent supply lines from Turkey on the one hand and cutting the Mosul and Aleppo supply route on the other as a precursor to the strategic defeat of ISIS. But in the face of these actions, Western leaders are widely seen to be preventing this and even seem to wish to impede and to inflict direct pain on Russia and other attempts to defeat the radical caliphate forces by endorsing a wave of TOW missiles and MANPADs reaching Syria from their Gulf suppliers. So where exactly does the West stand? Okay, let's take an aside for a moment, and let me put this into perspective for those of you who may not have been following all the different stories. What he is saying and what the actual evidence acknowledges and what the general said is that we want to get rid of Assad. Not that he was any different than any of the other leaders of countries, but he was not in alignment with us or Saudi Arabia. or Egypt for that matter, and therefore he was siding with the Iran and the Islamic movement, or not the Islamic movement, the Shia movement in Iran. So what do? We actually funded, trained, and saw that supplies went from Benghazi in Libya and the CIA mission into different ports in Syria that were controlled by rebel factions, including al-Nusra and al-Qaeda. The weapons that were being used against Assad to get rid of him were coming from the United States and Israel and other countries, including France, as well as multiple advisors and reconnaissance, tactical and intelligence information. So in effect, we were playing this game. Let's get rid of Assad. Then all of Syria becomes a failed state. Then Saudi Arabia will come in, Turkey will come in, and they'll take control. They'll exploit its oil and other resources. And it will also then mean that Israel will have another one of the dominoes fall in what they accept as a part of their foreign policy goals. What they did not count upon was that the entire Iraqi military establishment would become assaulted by ISIS, and in one of the most rapid military moves ever, they would make great progress. In the process of making progress into Iraq, they would take over arms by the thousands of trucks and tanks and anti-missile devices that we, the United States, have given to Iraq. So now they're well-armed. Now, of course, they were well-funded because Saudi Arabia was also funding them and training them. And there was a safe passage from all over the world through Turkey right into Syria. We knew all this. We supported it. What we didn't count upon was Russia and Iran coming in at the last moment, just before maybe 1 or 2 weeks more, and Assad would have had to have gotten out of the country because it would have been overwhelmed. Russia came in, Iran came in, Hezbollah came in, and some of the elements of let's say the pro-Syrian allies, of which there are only a few in the area, they were up against insurmountable odds. Well, that caused a stalemate. And then Russia says, hold on a second. They're not bombing ISIS. They're not trying to destroy it, yet we have been supposedly bombing ISIS for a year. What did we not bomb? We didn't bomb any of their oil trucks going from Syria into Turkey. There was open borders. Our reconnaissance would have known that. Our National Security Agency, our National Intelligence Agency, all knew that ISIS was getting oil from the conquered oil fields in Syria and also in Iraq, pumping thousands of trucks with oil, taking it into Turkey, and from Turkey, the oil was then being sold to Israel, a major supplier that we now know, and we know who was involved and how much they spent per gallon. They were getting it very cheap, under $20 a gallon, when everyone else in the world was paying for the same kind of quality oil, somewhere around $40 or higher. So ISIS was making anywhere between $2 to $4 million a day, more than enough to fund what they needed, plus they had backup financial support from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and some of the other United Arab Emirates states that were on their side. So here you've got one piece of the puzzle. America is behind the creation and support and financing of the caliphate forces that are going to be used to take over Syria. But hadn't anyone looked at what happened when they did the same thing in Libya, taking over Gaddafi? Libya, by the way, prior to the NATO attack on it, which was an illegal war, an illegal attack, was the most wealthy country of the 54 countries in Africa. It had one of the highest levels of education, free health care, free education, a home paid for, zero unemployment, and thousands of dollars when you got married, when you had children, maternity leave. And they had the most women occupying positions of authority and in the government body of any country in the Middle East, dwarfing all the other countries combined. So if you took all the women in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, other countries such as Abu Dhabi and Dubai, and put them all together, Libya was more secular, more open, more advanced, and had no major terrorism at all. And so, but instead of that, we said, he's our enemy, and we went after him through propaganda and lies. Now it's a failed state. Now it's the largest breeding ground for terrorists in the world, in Libya. We created that. Hillary Clinton, Obama, NATO, the neocons created it. Great for the manufacturing of weapons, not good for the people of Libya, who are frequently those who are trying to escape. It's civil wars. There are multiple factions fighting. Over 200 different tribes are now fighting in Libya. There's no stability anywhere in Libya. There's no security anywhere in Libya. There's no quality of life anywhere in Libya. Now we're trying to do the same thing with Syria. And it would have happened were it not for Russia. But Russia starts bombing al-Qaeda, al-Nusra. There's over 14 separate radical Islamic groups operating in Syria. And they're bombing all of them, plus ISIS. But then they go after the oil trucks. Isn't it amazing that we never bombed any of their oil supplies, nor did we tell Turkey to close your border, nor did we prevent any of the foreign fighters from getting in to Syria from Turkey? So that gives you a perspective. Now, all of that I just said is fully documented, but you won't hear this in the American media, and that's unfortunate. The mess that the West is in is apparent to all across the region. The U.S. and its allies are both ostensibly at war with the beheading radical Sunni forces and in bed with them at the same time. And how could this have happened? How could this mess be resolved? The roots of U.S. ambivalence towards fired-up radical Sunni Islam lie primarily with the group of American neoconservatives who formed an influential Cold Warrior nexus around Vice President Dick Cheney and who were obsessed with rolling back Soviet influence in the Middle East and in overturning the Arab socialist nationalist states, who were viewed both as Soviet clients and as a threat to Israel. David Wormerster, Cheney's Middle East advisor, stressed in 1996, quote, limiting and expediting the chaotic collapse, end quote, of Baathism must be America's foremost priority in the region. Well, secular Arab nationalism should be given no quarter, not even, he added, for the sake of stemming the tide of Islamic fundamentalism. So in setting the destruction of secular nationalism as its overwhelming priority, America by default found itself compelled to be allied with the Gulf kings and emirs who traditionally have resorted to Sunni jihadism as the inoculation against democracy. But America's and Britain's use of radical Sunni jihadist movements for their greater geopolitical ends was already well embedded long before 1996. In fact, when asked whether he regretted the CIA giving covert support to jihadists in Afghanistan 6 months prior to the Soviet military intervention at Kabul's request, President Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, said, quote, indeed, it was July 3, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive to secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul, that's in Afghanistan. The Soviets intervened December 24, 1979, and the very day I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid to the radical Islamic forces was going to induce a Soviet military intervention in Afghanistan. Question: despite this risk. You were an advocate of this covert action, but perhaps you yourself desired the Soviet entry into war and looked to provoke it, Brzezinski. It isn't quite that. We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. So when the Soviets justified their intervention by asserting that they intended to fight against the secret involvement of the United States in Afghanistan, people didn't believe them. Well, they were right. However, there was a basis of truth. Brzezinski, regret what? That secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap. And you want me to regret it? The day that the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote to President Carter, we now have the opportunity of giving the USSR its Vietnam War. Question, and neither do you regret having supported the Islamic Mujahideen, having given them arms and advice to future terrorists? Brzezinski, what is most important to the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire, some stirred-up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe in the end of the Cold War? Question, some stirred-up Muslims, but it's been said and repeated Islamic fundamentalism represents a world menace today. Brzezinski, nonsense. So understand that the United States government under President Carter, who was not a pacifist, he was implicit in multiple regime changes, no different than Barack Obama. It's amazing how his reputation for the good work he has done since leaving the White House they have whitewashed much of what he did on the inside, which was, in my opinion, crimes against humanity. And though the pinnacle of using fired-up Sunni jihadists for United States geopolitical ends was already well established, the roots of today's American-Syrian mess lie more in the events of 2006 and 7. The 2003 war in Iraq had not brought about a pro-Israeli, pro-American regional bloc that had been foreseen by the neocons, but rather it had stimulated a powerful Shia crescent. Now remember, the Shia are the minority, and most of the people in the Arab world are Sunni, and these Sunni do not like the Shia, and they have been attacked throughout history, and so they were fearful of this Shia movement. The Sunni states, quote, were petrified of the Shia resurgence, and there was growing resentment with our gambling on the moderate Shias in Iraq. U.S. government consultant had said at the time, quote, we cannot reverse the Shia gain in Iraq, but we can contain it. And it had been Israel's failure in its 2006 war to seriously damage Hezbollah in Lebanon that had been the straw, as it were, that broke the camel's back. So unnerving Israel and Gulf leaders, it provoked, too, a fierce debate within Washington. Quote, it seems there had been a debate inside the government over what the biggest danger was, Iran or Sunni radicals. Valen Nasser, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, told Seymour Hersh, quote, the Saudis and some in the administration have been arguing that the biggest threat is Iran, and the Sunni radicals are the lesser enemies. This is a victory for the Saudi line. So, another piece of the puzzle is that because we were doing business, huge business with Saudi Arabia, we allowed them, in effect, to control our foreign policy. They have been all along supporting terrorists more than any other nation in the world, more than any government in the world. Terrorists emerged from Saudi Arabia. Where did the major number of the hijackers of the plane who flew in the World Trade Center? They were trained, financed by Saudi Arabia. Why is it that no administration wants to turn over the transcripts of what actually happened that included Saudi Arabia? Because they have power. When we're buying their oil and they're buying our weapons to the tune of over $70 billion, then we then become passive in spite of all of their human rights record and they're invading other countries, including Yemen. causing a major humanitarian disaster there. Remember, Yemen is much larger than Syria. So you're going to see a flood of millions of Yemenites trying to find a peaceful place to be. Saudi Arabia has blockaded Yemen from any humanitarian aid. So the children are dying. Civilians are dying. They're bombing hospitals. They're bombing schools. Saudi Arabia are just absolutely despicable, homicidal maniacs. They're the most dysfunctional group of people on the planet. If this were the 1930s, they would be right there with the Waffen-SS. These people have no morals, no ethics, no sense of irony, because in the end, if they ever lose control over the Wahhabists in their country will rip them to pieces, all 5,000 members of the royal family. But we are protecting them. We are not attacking them in the media. The media won't touch them. And yet they're behind all this. So in an interview with The Telegraph in 2007, David Wiersma, former advisor to Cheney, and John Bolton confirmed, quote, that this would include the willingness to escalate so far as we need to go to topple the Syrian regime if necessary, meaning work with the jihadists. And hence the idea that we have moderate terrorists, moderate beheaders. What, do they cut your head half off? Moderate people who abuse women, rape girls, sexually mutilate them. That's who our allies are. Let's be very clear on this issue. And the president is completely supported along with the vice president of this policy. Now, this is from Robert Perry. Can Obama level with the American people? The atrocities in Paris, killing more than 120 people, have brought forth the usual condemnation against terrorism and expressions of sympathy for the victims. But the larger question is whether this latest shock will finally force Western leaders to address the true root causes of the problem. Will President Barack Obama and the leaders finally level with the American people and the world about what the underlying reasons for this madness are? Will Obama explain how U.S. allies in the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Qatar, have been fueling this Sunni extremism for years? Will they dare recognize that Israel's repression of the Palestinians is a major contributing factor also? On a practical level, will Obama finally release those 28 pages from the Congressional 9/11 report that address evidence of Saudi Arabia support for the hijackers who attacked New York and Washington in 9/11? Does he have the courage to explain how this scourge of Sunni terrorism can be traced back even further to the late 1970s when Jimmy Carter started a small-scale covert operation in Afghanistan to destabilize a Moscow-backed secular regime in Kabul, and that President Ronald Reagan then vastly expanded the program with the help of the Saudis, pouring in a total of $1 billion a year and giving rise to Saudi militant Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda? Can Obama be convinced that telling hard truths to the American public is not only vital to the Democratic Republic in a philosophical way, but can have the practical effect of creating crucial public support for rational policies? Will he realize that propaganda schemes or strategic communications may be clever, short-term tricks to manipulate the American people, but they are ultimately counterproductive and dangerous? Will Obama finally take on Washington's official, well-entrenched neoconservatives and their liberal interventionists, junior varsity, by challenging their innumerable false narratives? Will he pointedly blame the neocons and the liberal hawks, including those who run the editorial pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times, for the disastrous Iraq war? Will he take on the deep state dug in that at the big bank and the big think tanks and the big armaments companies, not just the neocon havens like the American Enterprise Institute, but at the center, left Brookings Institution? Can the president muster the courage to ally himself with the American people, arming them with real information so they can act like true citizens in a republic rather than the cattle being herded towards the slaughterhouse? Can he shake his own elitism or his fear of social ostracism to somehow become a true leader in his last year in office, rather than a timid follower of the prevailing group think? Just because the important people have fancy credentials and went to the right schools doesn't mean that they have any monopoly on wisdom. Indeed, in my nearly 40 years covering official Washington, these smart folks have been wrong a lot more than they have been right. A leader of historic dimensions recognizes that reality and takes on the know-it-alls. In this case, a leader who enlists the American public by giving them reliable information could change this depressing dynamic. If Obama could muster such courage and show trust in the people, he could bend the prevailing false narratives in the direction of truth and reality. Instead, Obama could twist the arms of his Saudi, Qatari, and Turkish friends to get them to halt their financing and military support for Sunni jihadists associated with al-Qaeda and its various spinoffs, like the Islamic State and al-Nusra Front. He could work cooperatively with Russian President Vladimir Putin to squeeze concessions out of both the Assad regime and the U.S.-financed moderate opposition so a unity government could begin to restore some order in Syria and isolate the extremists. Once those security issues are achieved, the Syrian people could hold elections and decide their own future and pick their own leaders. And so that is another perspective from Robert Perry, keeping in mind that if you wanted to end the Islamic terrorist in the Middle East, you're not going to do it militarily. It is not humanly possible. Because remember, it's not just a person you're trying to capture or kill. It's an ideology, and ideologies can never be destroyed militarily. You have to have several other components. First, you have to stop that which is feeding and financing him, and that would be the entire Arab nations, both all of them, because they all have a dog in this fight, and they're all looking to have something that gains them something politically, economically, and in their overall philosophy of who should be in control. So if you had Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Qatar stop financing, protecting terrorists and went after them, you would see an enormous decrease. Then you have to have every spiritual leader, every emir, every person within the Islamic community protest, actively protest, take to the streets to protest, in the mosque and protest the jihadist view of their reality. If you do those two things together and then rebuild the communities so that the poor who are frequently joining these movements are given jobs and homes and self-sufficiency, you would take away much of the impotence that has caused this and then remove our bases, get us out of their lives. I'm Gary Nall. We're now going to go over and we're going to hear a series of clips on this issue. And our first clip that we're going to listen to is important because it's how to respond to someone who blames all Muslims for ISIS, as we have so many people now willing to do, especially the presidential candidates. And it simply should be addressed.
Does Islam promote violence? Islam doesn't promote violence or peace. Islam is just a religion, and like every religion in the world, it depends on what you bring to it. If you're a violent person, your Islam, your Judaism, your Christianity, your Hinduism is going to be violent. There are Buddhist, marauding Buddhist monks in Myanmar slaughtering women and children. Does Buddhism promote violence? Of course not. People are violent or peaceful, and that depends on their politics, their social world, the way that they see their communities, the way they see themselves.
So, Reza, you don't think that there's anything more... There's the justice system in Muslim countries, you don't think, is somehow more primitive or subjugates women more than in other countries?
Did you hear what you just said? You said in Muslim countries. Mm. I just told you that Indonesia, women are absolutely 100% equal to men. Mm. In Turkey, they have had more female representatives, more female heads of state in Turkey than we have in the United States.
But in Pakistan,
stop saying things like Muslim countries.
Women are still being stoned.
And that's a problem for Pakistan. You're
right.
So let's criticize Pakistan.
I just want to be clear on what your point is, because I thought you and Bill Maher were saying the same thing. Your point is that Muslim countries are not to blame. There is nothing particular, there's no common thread in Muslim countries. You can't paint with a broad brush that somehow their justice system or Sharia law or what they're doing in terms of stoning and female mutilation is different than in other countries like Western countries.
Mm-hmm. Stoning and mutilation and those barbaric practices should be condemned and criticized by everyone. The actions of individuals and societies and countries like Iran, like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia must be condemned because they don't belong in the 21st century. But to say Muslim countries as though Pakistan and Turkey are the same, as though Indonesia and Saudi Arabia are the same, as though somehow what is happening in the most extreme forms of these repressive countries, these autocratic countries, is representative of what's happening in every other Muslim country, is frankly, and I use this word seriously, stupid. So let's stop.
This is from Peter Van Buren. What if the United States, or what if they gave a war and everybody came? I thought that this was particularly interesting. It's not long, but I'll share it with you. What if the United States had not invaded Iraq in 2003? How would things be different in the Middle East today? Was Iraq, in the words of presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, quote, the worst foreign policy blunder in American history? Let's take a big picture tour of the Middle East and try to answer those questions. But first, a request. After each of the statements I'm going to make, could you make sure to add the one question, what could possibly go wrong? Let the history begin. In March 2003, when the Bush administration launched its invasion of Iraq, the region, though simmering as ever, looked like this. Libya was stable, ruled by the same strongman for 42 years. In Egypt, Hosni Mubarak had been in power since 1983. Syria had been run by the Assad family since 1971. Saddam Hussein had essentially been in charge of Iraq since 1969, formally becoming president in 1979. The Turks and Kurds had been an uneasy but functional ceasefire, and Yemen was quiet enough. Other than the terror attack on the USS Cole in 2000, relations between the U.S. and most of these nations were so warm that Washington was routinely rendering terrorists to their dungeons for some outsourced torture. Soon after March 2003, when U.S. troops invaded Iraq, neighboring Iran faced two American armies at the peak of their strength. To the east, the U.S. military had effectively destroyed the Taliban and significantly weakened al-Qaeda, both enemies of Iran, but had replaced them as an occupying force. To the west, Iran's decade-old enemy, Saddam Hussein, was gone, but similarly replaced by another massive occupying force. From the position of weakness, Iran's leaders, no doubt terrified that the Americans would pour across its borders, sought real diplomatic reapproachment with Washington for the first time since 1979. Iran's efforts were rebuffed by the Bush administration. Were you told that? Did you know that? Iran wanted peace. The Bush administration did not. Then you had their precipitating event. Nailing down causation is a tricky thing, but like the June 1914 assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand that kicked off the Great War, the one to end all wars, America's 2003 invasion was what novelists refer to as the precipitating event, the thing that may not actively cause every plot twist to come, but that certainly acts, sets them in motion. There hadn't been such an upset in the balance of power in the Middle East, well, since World War I, when Great Britain and France secretly reached an agreement which, among other things, divided up most of the Arab lands that had been under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. That would be Turkey. And because the national boundaries created then did not represent on-the-ground tribal, political, ethnic, or religious realities, they could be said to have set the stage for much that is to come. Now, fast forward to 2003, as the Middle East had become in the process of unraveling. Those U.S. troops had rolled into Baghdad only to find themselves standing there, slack-jawed, gazing at the chaos. Now, fast forward one more time to 2015, and let the grand tour of the unraveling begin. Take a look at the sick men of the Middle East. It's easy enough to hustle through three countries in the region in various states of decay before heading into the heart of the chaos. Libya is a failed state, bleeding into northern Africa. Egypt is failed its Arab Spring test and relies on the U.S. to support its anti-democratic as well as anti-Islamic fundamentalist militarized government. And Yemen is a disastrously failed state, now the scene of a proxy war between the U.S.-backed Saudi Arabia and Iran-backed Houthi rebels, with a thriving al-Qaeda outfit and a small but growing arm of Islamic State thrown into the bargain. Look at Iraq. Obama is now the fourth president of the United States in a row to have ordered the bombing of Iraq, and his successor will almost certainly be the fifth. If ever a post-Vietnam American adventure deserved to inherit the moniker of quagmire, Iraq is it. And here's the saddest part of the tale. The forces loosened there in 2003 have yet to reach their natural endpoint. Your money should be on the Shias. But imagining that there is only one Shia horse to bet on means missing just how broad the field really is. What passes for a Shia government in Baghdad today is a collection of interest groups, each with its own militia, and having replaced the one strongman prime minister, Nur al-Maliki, with a weak one, Haider al-Abadi. And with ISIS chased from the gates of Baghdad, each Shia faction is now free to jockey for position. The full impact of the cleaving of Iraq has yet to be felt. At some point, expect a civil war inside of a civil war. And then you look at Iran. If there is any unifying authority left in Iraq, it's Iran. After the initial 2003 blitzkrieg, the Bush administration version of neocolonial management in Iraq resulted in the rise of Sunni insurgents, Shia militia, and an influx of determined foreign fighters. Tehran rushed into the power vacuum, and in 2011, in an agreement brokered by the departing Bush administration and carried out by President Obama, the Americans ran for the exit. The Iranians stayed. Now they have entered an odd couple marriage with the United States against what Western interests in Washington pretends is a common foe, ISIS, but which the Iranians and their allies in Baghdad see as a war against the Sunnis in general. At this point, Washington has all but ceded Iraq to the new Persian Empire. Everyone is just waiting for the paperwork to clear. The Iranians continue to meddle in Syria as well, supporting Bashar al-Assad under Russian air cover. Iran is increasing its troop presence there too. According to a recent report, Tehran has sent 2,000 troops to Syria, along with 5,000 Iraqi and Afghan Shia fighters. Then you have the Kurds. The idea of creating a Kurdistan was crossed off the post-World War I to-do list. In 1920, the Treaty of Sarajevo at first left an opening for a referendum on whether the Kurds wanted to remain part of what remained of the Ottoman Empire or become independent. Problem one, the referendum did not include plans for the Kurds in what became Syria and Iraq. Problem two, the referendum never happened. A victim of the so-called Turkish War of Independence, the result, 20 million angry Kurds scattered across parts of modern Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. They once had their own home, and since the end of World War I, they've had no home. And that American invasion 2003, however, opened the way for the Kurds to form a virtual independent statelet, a confederacy, if you will, even if still confined within Iraq's borders. At the time, the Kurds were labeled America's only true friends in Iraq and rewarded with many weapons and much looking the other way, even as Bush administration officials blathered on about the goals of a united Iraq. In 2014, the Kurds benefited from U.S. power a second time. Desperate for someone to fight ISIS after Iraq's American-trained army turned tail and ran, well, in came the Kurds. And the Kurds began to fight against ISIS and began to win. And then they became our new allies. Turkey, talk about a corrupt country. Talk about a country that is vile and evil in its body politic, though not its population, in every sense. And it has played everyone. They are They are in this for the money and for the power. Massive amounts of money. Just unfathomable by the normal idea of what a person can earn. But when you are controlling trucks coming into your country and you're getting a payoff on every truck, and there are thousands of trucks a week, imagine how much you earn, especially if you're the head of the country and his son. Relations between the Turks and the Kurds have never been good, both inside Turkey and along the Iraq-Turkey border. Inside Turkey, the primary Kurdish group calling for an independent state is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, also known as the PKK. Its first insurgency ran from 1984 to 1999 when the PKK declared a unilateral ceasefire. The armed conflict broke out again in 2004, ending in a ceasefire in 2013, which was in turn broken recently. Over the years, the Turkish military also carried out repeated ground incursions and artillery strikes against the PKK inside Iraq. As for ISIS, the Turks long had a kind of one-way, open-door policy on their border with Syria, allowing Islamic State fighters and foreign volunteers to transit into that country. ISIS also brokered significant amounts of black market oil in Turkey to fund itself, perhaps with the tacit support or at least the willful ignorance of the Turkish authorities. And while the Turks claimed to see ISIS as an anti-Assad force, some felt Turkey's generous stance toward the movement reflected the government's preference for having anything but an expanded Kurdish presence on its border. So if you can understand this, Turkey wanted the terrorists, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and ISIS, to kill off all of the Kurds. And by allowing them in, they were not only killing off Assad's Syrian army, they could then turn around and kill off all the Kurds. And in the process, Turkey got rich on the money. So these are some of the players, and then you have to ask, gee whiz, why hasn't any of this become public knowledge in the United States? Let's go back now and to listen to our next audio clip. And in this audio clip, you will hear the whole discussion about the war on terror, a reality check from Mehdi Hasan.
Ah, the good old war on terror, which started with such grand ambitions. Yet after 14 years, $4.4 trillion, hundreds of thousands dead, is the world any safer? Has the war been won? Not quite. Between 2002 and 2014, the US government estimates that death from terrorism went up by 4,500%. If that's winning, I wouldn't want to see losing. Take Iraq. Before the invasion in 2003, there were no recorded suicide attacks in that country's history. None. Since 2003, 1,892 suicide attacks, killing almost 20,000 people. One al-Qaeda strategist went as far as to say that the war in Iraq almost single-handedly rescued the jihadi movement. You may have heard of ISIL. It didn't exist on 9/11. Just saying. If you're still not convinced that all the so-called war on terror has given us is more war and more terror, check out Afghanistan. Insurgents killed 2,643 Afghan civilians last year, the highest number since UN records began. And remember, the Taliban were supposed to have been defeated back in 2001. Then there's Pakistan.
There's more extremism today in Pakistan than ever in our history.
In the 14 years before 9/11, there was one suicide attack on Pakistani soil. One. In the 14 years since, 486 suicide bombings, causing more than 6,000 deaths. And the story is tragically the same in Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Nigeria, and Syria, where the situation is now so dire that you'll never believe who the former head of the CIA has apparently called on for help against ISIL. Yep, Al-Qaeda. Full circle, full failure.
Now, I want to give you an example of what happens when we, the United States, make a mistake. Let's say we are using drones and we kill innocent civilians. We cover it up. We never come forward and acknowledge we made an enormous mistake. Here's how we made it. Here's who made it. And here's the responsible person being put into a process of being held accountable. We don't do that. Here's Noam Chomsky on the U.S. bombing of the hospital in Afghanistan.
In the case of the Kunduz hospital, apparently, I mean, I don't think all the details have come out, but it seems that they were trying to kill some people they regarded as Taliban leaders or activists. And they happened to be in the hospital, so they killed everybody. And there's a lot of criticism of killing the others. What about killing the person they were targeting? I mean, what right do we have to kill somebody in some other country who we don't like? I mean, I don't like them either, you know, don't like the Taliban at all. But does that mean we have a right to go kill them? I mean, do they have a right to go kill us if they don't like us? That's not questioned at all. What's questioned is, and criticized, is attacking a hospital and killing the staff and killing the patients. And, you know, it's not the first time. So, for example, when the U.S., one of the lauded achievements of the U.S. Army in Iraq is the conquest of Fallujah in November 2004. Take a look at it. Just take a look at the New York Times, the days of the attack on Fallujah. The first day of the attack, there's a picture on the front page, you can practically visualize it, which is a picture of the General Hospital in Fallujah. Marines attacked the General Hospital, threw the patients off their beds, put them on the floor, put shackles around them, threw the doctors on the floor. Attacking a hospital is a gross violation of international law. But they were asked, and they were asked, why did you attack it? They said because it was a propaganda agency for the rebels. How was it a propaganda agency? It was releasing casualty figures.
And that's Noam Chomsky. It becomes absurd that when we kill people with intent, it is never a crime. No one's ever held really accountable. Now the question is, why do people become Islamic extremists? Let's listen to this clip.
What drives someone to become a religious extremist, even to the point of becoming a suicide bomber? Like most people, I assume that there were two overriding answers, poverty and ignorance. The poverty line goes like this. Grinding poverty from which there appears to be no escape fosters seething resentment against those who have more. If your choice is to die a martyr or die a beggar, martyrdom is the clear winner. The ignorance lines goes like this. The poor have no chance to get a decent education and thus are susceptible to easy manipulation. Clever people play on their prejudices and superstitions. Once the extremist gets this ignorant, poor person in his grasp, indoctrination is easy. Since there's plenty of poverty and plenty of ignorance around the world, that's a lot of people to draw from. This is how the source of terrorism is explained. Then I went to Pakistan and actually lived in the world from which extremists recruit, and I found something much different than I expected. Poverty had little to do with who became an extremist, lack of education even less. Many of those that I met who subscribe to religious extremism and are prepared to murder and die for their cause are from the middle class, and many had a university education. These are not poor people, and these are not uneducated people. They are well-fed and well-read. So if poverty and ignorance don't drive people to extremism, what does? One is a desire for meaning and for order. Places like Pakistan are submerged in chaos and corruption. Islamists promise clear-cut solutions to every problem. Here's how things will change if you follow these rules, and only these rules. Another is a desire for change. The old corrupt order, the narrative goes, must be overthrown, and that can only happen through violent action. Again, it is Islamists that step in with a promise to create a new form of government. Then throw in a strong sense of victimhood. We are not responsible for the sorry state of our country. Others have brought us down, and you have a toxic brew that many willingly imbibe. These, of course, are the same easy answers that tyrants and demagogues, from Lenin to Mussolini, to Hitler, to bin Laden, have always offered their followers. I saw this played out one day while living in Pakistan. After one of the many assassinations of a major figure there, I was sitting with two middle-class parents. The father owned a small business, and the mother was a nurse. They had given their son a good life. He wanted for nothing. They told me that during dinner with the family a few days earlier, their son noted how the person who was murdered deserved to die. Why? Because he had spoken out on behalf of religious minorities. They were shocked. How could their son, who'd been educated and well-raised, think that? This story is all too typical. So what to do about this extremism? The first step is to get off this false narrative that this is first and foremost a poverty or education issue. The second is to take on the narrative of the extremist groups. They promise a better way, but what in fact do they deliver? The answer is always more death, more suffering, and more poverty. In other words, young people need to see these extremist groups for what they are. Only then will recruitment numbers begin to go down. Third, the media have to stop treating extremists as freedom fighters, a narrative that is all too common in places like Pakistan. Fourth, teachers and parents cannot assume that just because they reject religious extremism, their children and students will too. Middle-class parents and teachers have to be vigilant in instilling moderate, pluralist values in their children. Fifth, politicians have to stop blaming their country's problems on the West and have to confront the endemic corruption that destroys countries like Pakistan from within. Sixth, and probably most important, Islamic religious figures have to stop looking the other way, or worse, glorifying so-called martyrs, Muslims who murder innocent people. Almost always other Muslims in the name of Islam. Muslim religious leaders must promise these murderers eternal damnation, not some sort of twisted heavenly bliss. The people of Pakistan and other Muslim-majority countries have real grievances, but extremism only makes things worse, always and everywhere. It's not poverty and misery that creates religious extremism. It is religious extremism that creates poverty and misery and death. I'm Haroon Ulla, adjunct professor at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service for Prager University.
And finally, we will close out this segment of our program. We'll go a little bit over our normal time to get it in. The debate that you do not hear in the United States about some of the adjunct groups who are part of this Middle East conflict and how we do not talk about this anywhere in the American media.
Israel is really fighting a war on two fronts. The first is a military campaign being waged in the occupied territories against the Palestinian people. And the second is a PR campaign being waged here in the U.S. through the American media to ensure continued support for Israel's occupation. Alon Pincus, Consul General for Israel in New York and the coordinator of Israel's PR efforts, was recently quoted as saying, "We are currently in a conflict with the Palestinians, and engaging in a successful PR campaign is part of winning the conflict." So you could say that in addition to the military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, Israel is also involved in an attempt to ideologically occupy the American media.
American news coverage is influenced by a complex set of institutional relationships. These influences can be thought of as a series of filters through which the news must travel before it emerges in the voices of news anchors. To understand how American news media report on the Middle East conflict, we need to understand how these institutional filters operate. Among the most important of these filters are the business interests of the corporations that own the mass media, interests that extend beyond the United States and across the globe to the Middle East. The economic interests of media owners are shared by political elites, politicians and policymakers who form a second filter. These political elites have the power to access and influence mainstream media and are themselves part of a system dominated by corporate money and interests. The strategic importance of the Middle East to these two groups is reflected in media coverage of the region and of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A third filter, Israel's own public relations efforts, further affects the coverage. The government of Israel employs some of the largest American public relations firms as image consultants to coordinate its political and media campaigns. 9 Israeli consulates help implement these PR campaigns by developing relationships with journalists and monitoring media outlets. Scores of private American organizations, both Christian and Jewish, reiterate the official line and organize grassroots opposition to any coverage deemed unfavorable to Israel. The most important of these is AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, widely regarded as the most powerful foreign lobby in Washington. This institutional framework of American business and political interests in combination with Israeli public relations shapes media coverage of the Middle East. At the same time, those progressive organizations opposing Israeli government policy, such as Jews Against the Occupation and Americans for Peace Now, rarely make it through these filters. Finally, if any news stories critical of Israeli policy do surface, there are a host of media watchdog groups that monitor and pressure journalists and media outlets, the most important of which is CAMRA.
You have, for example, an Israeli soldier who's on Palestinian territory shooting Palestinians. If he gets injured or killed, immediately you get the fullness of his humanity. You go to his funeral, you see his grieving mother or wife or child. You learn a lot, his name, his hopes, his dreams, where he came from, and so on. And yet you have, you know, hundreds and thousands of Palestinians killed. And you never get to know their name. You never get to see a funeral. You're not exposed to the grief of the family. You don't know that these children, probably many of them, were shot in their own homes, in their own backyards, or on the way to school. It doesn't matter. They become part of the abstraction. You know, 400 Palestinians killed, that's it. It's a number.
In the West Bank, a car explosion killed 3 Palestinians.
6 Palestinians were killed and 45 wounded by Israeli troops in various incidents.
About 20 Palestinians were killed today as Israeli warplanes, troops, and tanks targeted Palestinian militants.
Israeli soldiers fired on Palestinians violating the military curfew. At least 4 were killed.
There are other ways of reporting on Palestinian victims. In fact, when you look at the British press, the ways in which the Palestinian victims are dismissed and downplayed in the American media, the ways in which their deaths are justified in American coverage, becomes even more glaring. A really clear example of this is the BBC story on 6 Palestinian kids killed by an Israeli booby trap and 1 the next day by Israeli soldiers.
5 small bodies on their way to the grave, carried shoulder high, a martyr's funeral in Gaza for the dead schoolboys. Sources in the Israeli government and security services have admitted they were probably the victims of an Israeli booby trap. Victims who died side by side, 2 sets of brothers and a cousin, all members of 1 devastated Palestinian family, the Alastals. Naeem lost his oldest son and his youngest, who was only 6. Both good boys, he told me, who never gave any trouble. This Israeli minister wants a full inquiry, but claims it wasn't a civilian area.
Civilians were not there.
I stood there.
That's exactly what
minister,
was stated.
I stood there yesterday. This is an area where children pass to go to school. This is an area where people cultivate. I have stood there and I have seen it. Now, is it appropriate that a roadside bomb should be planted in this place?
That's exactly what will be investigated. That's exactly what will be investigated.
Even as he spoke, Palestinians say another child was killed in Gaza. They claim Israeli forces fired on these stone throwers, killing a 15-year-old called Wael. The army denies it.
If you look at the American coverage from the same day, you'd struggle to think of it as even the same event. The report practically blames the victims for their own deaths.
In Gaza, a Palestinian teenager was killed in a clash with Israeli troops following the funerals of 5 boys. They died Thursday when one of them kicked an unexploded tank shell.
We are out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.